Okay. Open your Bibles this evening to the book of Judges and find Judges chapter 3. Last week we kind of looked at the first part of the first three chapters here where we saw the introduction to what the book of Judges is about. And tonight we're actually going to try to move through several of these judges. And so if you have your sheet from last week, your sheet's on page 21. I'm going to pull this out because I fought with this last week. It might be helpful if you remember on the back of page 24, on the back of the sheet, that there was a map. And I actually referred to that several times again while I was even going back through reading through this and filling my sheet in. I haven't been filling mine in because I have all my notes already written out. But I thought maybe it's fair if I fill them in since you do. Judges chapter 3, and if you'd let's go to. Let's go to verse 7, Judges chapter 3 and verse 7, where we'll put it. It says, "And the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and forgot the Lord their God, and served Baals and Ashtaroth. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel." So,
is that okay, Jim?
No, that's all right. "So that he sold them into the hands of the Cush-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, and the sons of Israel served Cush-Rishathaim, 8 years old. I should have had my wife read those because we always have fun trying to pronounce those names. I get them hard when we're reading through the Bible. If the name's really hard, I go this guy and then this guy. And sometimes I press through and I try to do it. She usually tries to pronounce the name. She's more sticks with it more. But anyway, as a result, they're sold into the hands of these people 8 years. And that's important because as you're filling this out, one of the things I tried to do is to help you notice how many years they were under the hand of these people, number one, and number two, how many years of quiet or peace they have following. So at the beginning here, it tells us that they were under the hands of these people for 8 years. Okay? So it goes on in verse 9. It says, "And then the sons of Israel cried to the Lord." One of the things I did this afternoon with the book of Judges after I'd gone through and filled all this out was I went through and I marked every statement in here where it said God and Lord, because that really is the key, I think, in understanding. We have the judges, but it's not just like these were extraordinary characters that did extraordinary things. It's really in the end about God being faithful to what he told Israel he was going to do. And I think sometimes it's possible to get so into studying a topic that we can almost, by the time we're done with the topic, say, you know, we studied that topic, but we barely talked about God. Which is kind of funny when you're studying the scripture that we would actually do that. And so I think it's important here. It says that they cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised. He's the one that does this. It's not that this guy stood up and go, well, I'm going to take charge. No, the Lord raised up a deliverer for the sons of Israel to deliver them, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. Caleb being one of the two spies, one of the men that was involved in the conquest, one of the men that at 85 took, Mount Gerizim? I think I have the wrong mountain, but took the mountain up there to the north and takes that for his people because God had promised that to him. Well, now this is his younger brother, Othniel. And it says, "And the Spirit of the Lord," that is the Spirit who is the Lord, who is Jehovah, "he came upon him." Again, it's not just that God strictly gives instruction to these judges. Here's an instance where the Spirit comes and clothes upon Othniel, and he judged Israel. When he went out to war, the Lord gave, Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand so that he prevailed over Cush-Rishathaim. And then the land had rest 40 years, and Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. So the key here is we're introducing the first one is, the people sinned. God sells them to the hand of an enemy. The enemy then, putting this on him, causes Israel then to cry out to their Lord. The Lord listens or responds and raises up a judge and empowers that judge to do this, to carry this out. And here in this case, empowers him for military warfare, but then furthermore, that in doing so, God actually gives this enemy into their hand, turns them over. He's the one. So these people are defeated, not just because Othniel is like a great warrior, but because God is the one that's doing this. He's behind all this coming about. And then they have rest as a result of that for what did it say, for 40 years. But then verse 12, and the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so that the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel. Moab is east. Okay, so let's back up. And I put these notes off to the side. You don't have to do this. You can look at the map. But beside, because I didn't give you a place to do this, but beside Othniel, I just put out here in the margin, north. Because this happened in the north. In fact, when you look at some of the parts that are involved in this, you can see that this is the land in the north where they're dealing with. They're dealing with people that are coming from the north out of there. This next group, Moab, is east. So this is going to be a judge that's going to deal with what happens in the east. And we can read about this, and it says in verse 14, and the sons of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, for 18 years, in verse 14. So 18 years that they're under the king of Moab, it tells us. And when the sons of Israel, in verse 15, when the sons of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer from them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite. Benjamin, if you remember where Jerusalem is in Judah, is Benjamin is a smaller country directly to the north, but very close to just go over through Jericho and cross over to here where Moab is at, okay, where the king is at. If you have that map, just to kind of put this in perspective, let me open this up. Just above the Dead Sea, right here, this is where Benjamin is, right in this spot, above the Dead Sea. And Moab is right over here on this side is where they're going to be causing their problems, and they're coming across. And so all these events are going to take place in this area, just up to the north of the Dead Sea a little ways. Just to kind of put it in perspective for you, I think that maybe is perhaps helpful. But it goes on from here. Notice what it says. It tells us that he's a Benjamite. He's a left-handed man. There's a reason it tells us that he's going to be a left-handed man. So we're going to go through and read this. And the sons of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. And Ehud made himself a sword which had two edges. So it's not a single sword like an axe. It's a double-sided sword. A cubit in length. So it's a sword about that long. We're not talking about a big broadsword being swung by King Arthur. We're talking about a short, close-in combat sword, a cubit in length. And he bound it to his right thigh under his cloak. Now, just to put this in perspective, okay, let me stand up. I've never handled swords, except for the wooden ones that I made in my dad's garage as a kid. Normally, if you had a sword, you kind of like a... If a person carries a sidearm, they usually put it on the side that they grab, unless it's on a shoulder holster. Then it's over here. You reach across, and you did the same thing with your sword. If you were right-handed, you put your sword here, you reached across and pulled it out. You don't want to reach here and try to fight it out of its scabbard. So he's left-handed, and he binds the sword to his left leg. The significance of it is, what is it? 90% of the population or better are right-handed. He put it on his right leg. Yes. Yes. Bound to his right leg. So 90% of the population or better are right-handed.
Except for a lot of the Benjaminites, it seems like. There was a lot of them were
right-handed. They were, yeah, there were some lefties in there. So there were some southpaws in Benjamin. But he does that. Now, what's most likely going to happen when he goes up to see King Eglon?
They're going to check his right.
Yeah, they're going to check him over here. They're not going to pat him down completely, okay? In fact, later on when you read Deborah's song, later on in this book, there's a hint at one of the things that had happened. It said that there was no sword in the land. In other words, apparently one of the things that King Eglon did to secure himself, kind of like the communists did, is he made sure nobody had any arms. He didn't want people to have weapons. So you take all their weapons away from them. Well, he makes himself a sword, and he puts it on his right leg. So when they frisk him, they just check, no, there's nothing there, and he goes in. Well, that's okay, because he's going to reach and take one from the other side. Just to put it in perspective, okay? This honestly was probably about one of my favorite stories in the book of Judges as a kid. Maybe because I was a boy, okay? Most of you know where this story's going, right? Because you've read this. And it says in verse 17, and he presented it, the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. And it came about, now it's going to be important for what happens. And it came about when he had finished presenting the tribute that he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. And he himself turned back from the idols, which were at Gilgal. And that word idols, it's used twice in here, also in the Hebrew may refer to, it can refer to stone quarries, where they quarried stone for making idols. So it's not as though he walked out to the idols, but most likely he went as far as the stone quarries just outside the area where this city was at, which were at Gilgal, and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he said, keep quiet. And all who attended him left. And he who came to him while he was sitting alone in the cool roof chamber, and he who had said, I have a message from God for you, and he arose from his seat. And Ehud stretched out his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. Keep in mind now, we're talking about a sword that's this long. We're not talking about a dagger. We're talking about an 18-inch long sword, okay, cubit long. And it says, the handle also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade. Tells you how large this man was. So you can see why as a boy I thought this was a kind of a cool, gross story. For he did not draw the sword out of his belly, and the refuse came out. So, I mean, he really does this guy in. But it's telling you how sharp the sword was, too. You just don't take any kind of a sword and do this. It's a very sharp sword. He goes out, and just to kind of to give you a summary, the rest of this, he goes out, locks the doors as he leaves, so that locks the doors and then slips out another way, so that the people think that he's in there essentially using the bathroom. And they don't want to bother him. So they're knocking on the door and they're like, king, king. But nobody wants to walk in on the king for fear that, you know, might lose a head over this. They finally discover what happens. But it says, verse 26, now Ehud escaped while they were delaying. He passed again by the idols or by the quarries, escaped to Syrah. And it came about when he had arrived that he blew the trumpet in the hill country. Remember, they didn't have radios and everything. So how do you call people to war? There's certain trumpet sounds that you had. You people didn't grow up in tornado country. Peggy and I grew up in tornado country, and in our town, we had, and this is back pre-radio day, I mean, the people had radios, but most people didn't own them. And we lived a block from the water tower in our town, and on top of the water tower was a big siren. And if there was a fire, they ran that siren and go, real slow, and that called all the men that were volunteer firefighters to run into town, get to the fire truck, and go to the fire. But if it went, you knew that was a weather warning. Run to the basement. It meant that there was a tornado. So in the same way, these people had trumpets, and the people knew. They'd hear a trumpet blast, and they go, oh, that's a call to war. That guy's just out tooting his horn. That's a war call that I can hear from his trumpet. We know the difference between taps and reveille on a trumpet. Well, they had the same thing. And so he did this, and the sons of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was in front of them. And he said to them, pursue them. Now notice what Othniel does here, Ehud does. The Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hands. So they went down after him, seized him at the fords of the Jordan. Gilgal isn't very many miles from the Jordan River. So these people are fleeing from Israelite country to get across the Jordan River, and they flee. They meet him at the ford of the Jordan opposite Moab, and they did not allow anyone to cross. So they basically carried a roadblock at the one place people could conveniently cross the Jordan River. And they struck down at that time about 10,000 Moabites, all. Now, the New American Standard says all robust and valiant men. Most people take that to mean this wasn't just soldiers. This would be his elite guard. These were his. Well, it was 10,000. You can't have 10,000 SEAL Team 6, but you know, but it's like that. They're your elite guys. And it says, and no one escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land was undisturbed for 80 years. But again, it's the fact that God has raised this man up, and that Ehud recognizes God's given them into your hand. It's not just, this is not just people taking it on themselves to rise up and say, I'm going to rebel against this horrible, evil king. Okay? So we come to, and that's in the east. The next one, very short, verse 31, and after him came Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. And that's all it says about Shamgar. Yeah. We have that song we used to sing it in Sunday school. Shamgar had an ox goad. What? This would be in west, because it's the Philistines, and the Philistines are down in the the Philistines are in the southwest area, down by Gaza. No, that's Shamgar. In the north was Caleb's younger brother. Okay? He went up to the north. And Ehud is dealing with it in the east. So it's kind of important to kind of see how these things are going. Deliverance in the north, deliverance in the east, deliverance to the kind of the south and west, and kind of the heartland just off to the west of Jerusalem. Because God's just covering all this country by what he's doing here. Okay, any questions? Okay, we move on to the next one. Chapter 4 and verse 1. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Now Hazor is up in the north. It's north of Galilee. So again, this is a north conflict primarily. Because that's where he's up there north of Galilee. And if you look on the map, you do have Hazor. It's just a little ways north of Chinnereth, north of the Sea of Galilee on there. Okay. So it goes on from there, and it says, kind of tells you what happened, and it says in verse 3, and the sons of Israel cried to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots. Not wooden chariots, but iron chariots. These are, the thing is with iron chariots, you had to have more horses to pull them, but they were rather formidable, harder to fight against. You couldn't set them on fire. And the sons of Israel, and they oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. 20 years they're under the control of these people to the north. And now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. Now this is very important because when we started the study of Judges last week, we defined out of the book of Deuteronomy what a judge did. That a judge was a person that actually read the law and made determinations about how that law was to be implemented in areas of conflict. So the law didn't cover every last situation, but it covered enough that it could give these people discernment, and the priests and the judges were then to act in this way. So Deborah's doing this. To me, this is really interesting. Here's a woman that acts as a judge in Israel. Talk about a progressive nation. Anyway, and it tells us what she was doing. And she used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel. That's just to the north and a little west of Jerusalem in the hill country of Ephraim. And the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. So when they've got a question, how are we supposed to do this? They didn't go to the elders of the city. They were coming to this place and they were asking Deborah. And she was acting as judge. Now she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kedesh Naphtali, and said to him, behold, the Lord or Jehovah, the God of Israel, has commanded. So that's saying that God's given her direct revelation. Go and march to Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun. Those are two of the tribes, just to remind us. And I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army with his chariots, and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand. Then Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. So in other words, I'm not going to war unless you go, Deborah. So Deborah, he says, but if you will go not with me, then I will not go. And she said, well, I will surely go with you. So Deborah goes along. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey. In other words, she warns him, I'm going, but you're not the one that's going to get the honor for winning this battle. Here, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman. And again, that's not even going to be Deborah. She's not going to be the one. So they go on down there. There's a battle that takes place. It says in verse 14, Deborah said to Barak, arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men, and the Lord confused Sisera. So it's not even just that these men have to fight the battle really themselves. He causes confusion among these people, and all his chariots and his army with the edge of the sword before Barak, and Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. That tells you just how crazy this was, that this king in this great chariot with everything he had and all the horsemen doesn't go fleeing out of there, because you could go much faster in a chariot being pulled by horses than you're ever going to do on foot, especially probably because he has a little bit of battle armor on. And yet he flees on foot because there's such confusion. It's like these, shall we say, a traffic jam of chariots within this valley where this is at, and these people can't get out. And he flees on foot. He flees on foot, and it says in verse 18, verse 17. Now Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Now the Kenites were relatives of Moses. Moses' father-in-law was a Midianite. They are also called Kenites. So the Kenites were some non-Israelis that actually joined themselves to Israel because of Moses' father-in-law. And it says, and there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. In other words, generally they had gotten okay. So Sisera thinks, well, I can take shelter in this house. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, turn aside, my master, turn aside to me, do not be afraid. And he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, please give me a little water drink, for I am thirsty. So she opened a bottle of milk and gave him a drink, and then she covered him. And he said to her, stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and inquires of you and says, is there anyone here? That you shall say no. But Jael, the Heber's wife, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand and went secretly to him and drove the peg into his temple, and it went through into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted, and so he died. And behold, as Barak, that's the man that's leading the warfare, pursued Sisera, and Jael came out to meet him and said to him, come, and I will show you the man whom you're seeking. And he entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with the tent peg in his temple. So God subdued on that day Jabin the king of Canaan before the sons of Israel. And the hand of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Jabin the king of Canaan until they had destroyed Jabin the king of Canaan. And then chapter 5, we have a song. Now this is real interesting. You look at modern Christian music. I don't know if you've ever heard the joke, but modern Christian music, they call it a 24-7. It's 24 words repeated 7 times over and over and over. Well, you look at this. There's not a lot. There's no repetition. And this, yet this was a song. And this is more like the old hymns. And I don't know. You ever sing at Christmas time the First Noel? Because I think the First Noel is like 7 verses long. And it just goes through. It doesn't seem like much of a song. It tells the story in song form. You just keep singing and singing. It's kind of like listening to the Orth kids do their, what's it called? What?
Timeline?
Yeah, their timeline. Yeah, where they sing that timeline. It just kind of gives you a history in a timeline form, and they can sing all the way from the past down through the present. Well, that's what this does. And we're not going to go through and read this other than to point out in here that if there's several times in here that this, they give reference to the Lord and to God, and they recognize it's not us, but it's the Lord God that actually is going to do this. And it closes in verse 31, and it says, thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord, but let those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its might. And then it says, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years. So in the midst of this judges, we have this interesting scenario in which God actually delivers them through 2 different women. Deborah, who is actually acting as a judge, and then a woman who actually kills one of the chief kings that was involved, Sisera, that was leading this in here. And this is up, again, this is up to the north. But God's the one that's accomplishing these things. Okay, chapter 6 in verse 1, and the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian 7 years. Midian is to the east and south of the Dead Sea. The Midianites were actually distant relatives of Israel. Okay, and in fact, Moses' father-in-law was a Midianite originally. That's where he came from. He was one of the priests of Midian. but he also was a Kenizzite. But these are the Midianites of the south. They're under them 7 years. And it says, and the power of Midian prevailed against Israel because of Midian. The sons of Israel made for themselves the dens that were in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. In other words, they're so afraid of the Midianites that they're hiding out in the hills in caves like this. For it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites would come up with the Amalekites and the sons of the east and go against them, and they would camp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and they would leave no sustenance in Israel, as well as no sheep, ox, or donkey. So could you imagine that? In fact, verse 5 says they came and they were like locusts. They just take everything. Can you imagine what this is? You're a farm economy, and it all goes out, and unlike kids that maybe live on the west side of the state, these people understood, where does your food come from? The grocery store. Well, where does the grocery store get it from? The back room. No. These people understood it came from a field. Farmers raised that. And what happens if another enemy comes in and takes all of your crop? You go hungry. And that's what was happening, that the Midianites were taking all these things. And so it says, verse 6, so Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the sons of Israel cried to the Lord. Now it came about when the sons of Israel cried to the Lord on account of Midian that the Lord sent a prophet to the sons of Israel. And he said to them, well, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, it was I who brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of slavery. And I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hands of the oppressors and dispossessed them before you and gave you their land. And I said, I am the Lord your God. You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live. But you have not obeyed. So he kind of comes and sends a prophet, first of all, to get after them and say, hey, I'm the one that did all this. I'm the one that brought you up out of the land, and you're having these problems because you don't obey. But then it says in verse 11, and the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak that was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the wine press in order to save it from the Midianites. In other words, instead of beating out the wheat where you normally would on a threshing floor, where the Midianites probably had spies watching, oh, there's somebody, let him beat it out. And as soon as it's all he's done, we'll go down and take the grain. Why should we go down? Why should we have to beat it out? We'll let him do the work for us. So he goes and he finds a wine press, because it's a different harvest season, so they're not watching the wine press, and he's secretly beating out grain in a wine press. Everybody kind of has the picture in your mind. And it says, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him, verse 12, and said to him, the Lord is with you, O valiant warrior. So the Lord's with you. And Gideon said to them, O my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? Where are all the miracles or wonders which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? And now the Lord has abandoned us and given us the hand of Midian. And the Lord looked at him and said, go in your strength, deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you? And remember, verse 12, the angel of the Lord is God the Son. This is God the Son pre-incarnate. And so he said to him, O Lord, how shall I deliver Israel? Behold, my family is the least of Manasseh. We're not important people. And I am the youngest of my father's house. And the Lord said to him, surely I will be with you. You shall defeat Midian as one man. And so he asks for him in verse 17, he asks a sign. And the first sign he asks for is that he's going to go get an offering, he's going to bring it to him, and he wants the Lord to consume the offering. And it tells us in verse 21, and then the angel of the Lord put out the end of his staff that was in his hand, touched the meat, the unleavened bread, and fire sprang up from the rock, consumed the meat and the unleavened bread, and then the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. And Gideon saw that he was the angel of the Lord. He said, alas, O Lord God, for now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. In other words, he knows this is somebody important, but he doesn't know for sure that this is God himself. But when God himself reaches out his staff, touches this, and fire just springs out of the rock and consumes this offering, he knows that this is God, and he stands there kind of shaking. Notice what he does. Because this, I always know about Gideon and his 300 men, but I don't ever remember reading this story as a kid, and I know we did, but this is actually cool. And the Lord said to him, peace to you. Do not fear. You shall not die. Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and named it, the Lord is peace to this day. To this day it is still in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. And the same night it came about that the Lord said to him, take your father's bull and a second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father, and cut down, so no, it belongs to your father, and cut down the Asherah. Asherah, remember, are the poles that represent Baal's wife that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of this stronghold in an orderly manner. So it's just not thrown together. People can really tell you built a real altar here. And take a second bull and offer a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah, which you shall cut down. And Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord said, had spoken to him. And it came about, because he was too afraid of his father's household and the men of the city to do it by day, that he did it by night. In other words, Gideon is not particularly Mr. Brave. He's a little bit of a chicken doing this, but he's obeying. The people come out in the following verses, and they're going, hey, who tore down this altar? And they say, bring out the men that did this. And actually, Gideon's father comes, and he says, no. And he actually brings out his father, Jael, who had been part, or Joash, who had been part of this, says, you know what? Everybody here that is for the Lord, come out now. Come out and take your stand in this way. And they actually, let me try to find our verse in here. They actually renamed Gideon. We call him Gideon all the time, but they actually, oh, in verse 32, they named him Jerubbaal. That is, let Baal contend against him. Let Baal fight against this man. And this. In verse 34, it says, so the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, again, called to war, and the Abizarites were called together to follow him. Then in verses 36 through 40, we have, as God charges them to go off to war, we have one more set of signs, where he puts fleece down and he wants the ground wet, the fleece dry, and the fleece wet and the ground dry. Twice. So there's a total of 3 signs that Gideon asks for the Lord over just a short space of time. Chapter 7, we have Gideon being charged in verse 2. It says, and the Lord said to Gideon, the people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands, lest Israel become boastful, saying, my own power has delivered me. And so he goes to the people, and so 22,000 people returned, 10,000 remained. Those are the people, if you don't want to be here, go home. 22,000 leave. God says in verse 4, there are still too many, and so he tells them, I want them to drink water. And those people that actually kneel down to drink the water versus those that, shall we say, they kind of squat down and they bring water up with their hand to drink, those are the ones that he chooses. And he narrows it down. So in verse 6 it says, those that putting their hand to their mouth were 300 men. So you've gone from 30,000 down to 10,000 down to 300. Pared it way down. But all the rest of the people kneeled to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, I will deliver you with the 300 men who have lapped, and I will give the Midianites into your hand. And so indeed, they go out, they return to their tents. Verse 9 says, now the same night it came about that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given them into your hands. And they send them down there. If you remember in verse 16, he divided the 3 men into 3 companies, and he put trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them with torches inside the pitchers. And he said, look at me and do likewise. And behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. And when I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you also blow the trumpets all around the camp and say, for the Lord and for Gideon. And so Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirt of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. And when they had just posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and smashed the pitchers. Now, you can imagine what that's like. The trumpet is one thing, but the smashing of a pitcher, if you've ever broken pottery, when you listen to that crash, that smashing sound of pottery, so it's a rather loud kind of, you'd have to be wondering what that is, especially when you have not just one person doing this, but when you have 300 people, 100 with Gideon, but also these others that are there. And when the 3 companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing, and cried, the sword for the Lord and for Gideon. And each stood at his place around the camp, and all the army ran crying out as they fled. And when they fled, or when they blew the 3 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against another, even throughout the whole camp. See, in other words, the Midianites are there, and they're grabbing their swords and they're killing each other instead of the actual men that are opposing them. And it says, and the men of Israel were summoned from Naphtali and Asher and Manasseh, and they pursued Midian and Gideon. So they go, they let the rest of these people pursue them out there. But the main battle is fought by God with these 300 men, and he causes this confusion to come upon these people. And that is Gideon, his what God did with him. Tearing down of the altar and the destroying of these Midianites with this very small force in this situation. Now, I want to get the next part. Because in chapter 8, we continue to have the pursuit as Gideon continues to pursue and subdue all of these people. And I want to get down to, just trying to look at my, where we have this. Verse 22, here we go. Here you've had Gideon that God's done some of these, this great deliverance with. And it says in verse 22, and the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your sons, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord or Jehovah shall rule over you. In other words, Gideon, here was a man that realized he never would have taken up arms to fight against the Midianites. God had to come and tell him to do this. And he realized when they won the battle that it was not he and his ingenuity that won the battle, it was God that won the battle. So when these people want him to rule, he says, no, I'm not going to rule over you. My son's not going to rule over you. God rules over you. Jehovah rules over you. And so then they divide up this. And in verse 28 then says, so Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads anymore, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. So they have 40 years of quiet at the end of this. But then you go on down into chapter 9, our last section that we want to, chapter 8, verse 33. And it came about as soon as Gideon was dead that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the household of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel. Think about it. They've had 40 years of peace. He dies, and they just, like that, forget who really gave them this deliverance, and they don't even treat the household of Gideon well. This is the history of these people at this time. So we come down here, Gideon's dead, and chapter 9, verse 1, and Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, that's Gideon, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and spoke to them and to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father. Let's back up to verse 30. And it says of Gideon, it says, now Gideon had 70 sons who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives, and his concubine who was in Shechem also bore him a son, and named him Abimelech. Remember, a concubine is like a secondary, less official wife. But it is a type of a wife. So he's got many wives and 70 sons. That's going to be very important when we get down here into chapter 9. And we saw that verse 2, speak now, this is Abimelech, Gideon's son, speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Baal, rule over you, or that one man rule over you. Also remember that I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem, and they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our relative. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal Berith, that's this false god they're not supposed to be worshiping, with which Abimelech had hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. And then he went to his father's house at Ophrah, and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. So probably what they're doing is probably beheading these men. That's why he kills 70 of them. So they capture him. He's got all these men in his hand. They just keep bringing his brothers before him. If you've ever read through the Old Testament, you find that this is not the last time this is happening, that you have a king, he's threatened by the fact that he has brothers, so he has his brothers killed, so that his brothers can't challenge him on the throne. Well, that's what this man does. But if you'd look chapter 9, verse 22, because I didn't include this on here, But in 922, it tells us Abimelech ruled over Israel for 3 years. He's actually Israel's first king, but he's not a king set by God. He's a king that sets himself up. God will set Saul up. This is a king that set himself up and did this. And part of his overthrow is actually done by one of his brothers that actually manages to escape and actually is involved in his undoing. Last two judges tonight are each just a set of little verses in chapter 10. Chapter 10 and verse 1, it says, "Now after Abimelech died, Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar, arose to save Israel. And he lived in Shamer in the hill country of Ephraim." Ephraim is just north of Jerusalem, just north of the tribe of Benjamin. "And after him," and he judged Israel 23 years. Okay, so we have 23 years that he judged.
23 years of peace? Because it doesn't say that?
It would imply, yes, that there was probably 23 years of peace. And then verse 3, "And after him, Jair the Gileadite." Gilead is east of the Jordan River over on the other side, "arose, and he judged Israel 22 years. And he was actually a somebody, as we go, because it says, "And he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys. And they had 30 cities in the land of Gilead that are called the Havoth Jair to this day. And Jair died and was buried in Camah." In other words, he actually has control of these 30 cities. And he has 30 sons, and they ride 30 donkeys. Now, you don't appreciate that today, but that's like the difference between saying, how do you get around? I walk, versus how do you get around? I have a car. Having a donkey to ride on was a very big deal, okay? It'd be like today, the difference perhaps between a person driving an Escalade and an old Ford, okay? Or something like that. But so he is sort of a somebody in this. But again, Tola's in the middle and Jair's in east of this. But this is kind of, we're going to stop here tonight. We'll come back. We have some. We'll pick up some more of these next week because I don't want to get into Jephthah tonight. But hopefully, if there's been something we've been trying to point out, it's that these people are not self-appointed. Now, it doesn't tell you that particularly with these last two judges, but we've kind of had a trend set as we've gone through this. These aren't self-appointed men or women, for that matter, in the case of Deborah and Jael. These are people that God's appointing. These are people that God is coming to, and God is saying, "I want you to do this. This is what I want you to do." And these are people that, even if they're like Gideon, and they're maybe a little bit kind of a nervous Nelly, a little bit kind of a chicken heart with them, they do obey him, and they do trust God, and they recognize that God is the one that provides the deliverance. But, having said that, once the deliverance is provided, and once that judge dies, and he's not there to advise these people in the righteous conduct under the law, the people go back to worshiping Baal and these other deities. And again, just two points to make with regard to us here as we close, which kind of come out of what we said last week. You can't make your kids believers, but you can do the best job you can as a Christian parent of making sure your kids know who God is, know about God, and that you give God credit before your kids. That you actually, hopefully, let your kids recognize God's the one that does this. And we recognize God today. And it's real easy to not do that. It's real easy to get lazy in the Christian life and things happen and you don't stop and say, "Hey, we had to stop and take time to thank God for what he just did." I can think of several times as we were raising our daughters that something would happen. It would be kind of a difficult time. And you all get very uptight about it. How are we going to handle this? What's going to happen here? And you pray. And then when it gets fixed, great, it's gone. You just kind of go on with life. And you forget to take time to stop and say, "We know we got to stop right now and thank God for the way he put this together." Now, there were times we did that growing up with our girls. I wish I could say we did it every time, but I know for a fact I didn't. See, but that's one of the things that I think we really need to do. I don't want to allegorize or spiritualize what's happening with judges too much, but I think maybe it's a good point to learn that. But the other thing in here is always recognizing it's real easy to take on a job, to want to think, "I ought to go do this thing." without ever really being certain that it's what God really wants us to do. And none of these men ever accomplished this because they have themselves arrived at this conclusion, I ought to do this. They always knew that this is what God wanted them to do because, different than us, God did show up and talk to them. If you're waiting for God to come and talk to you and say you ought to do this, you're going to wait a long time because God doesn't do that.
Signs to show that he was God.
That's right. That's right. Okay, any questions tonight? Questions? Okay. If you got nothing else out of this tonight, you got to read a bunch of the book of Job or Judges tonight along with us. Well, Father, we're thankful for the evening, and again, thankful for your word. Thankful that you are a faithful God, faithful to the promises you made to Israel, as we see with these people, that even when they would turn their back, when they cried out, just as you said, you didn't say, I'm not going to help you anymore, but you actually did respond. And you told them that you would do so, and you raised up those men and empowered those men and women to actually deliver these people. And we're thankful as we get to see that faithfulness, that it reminds us that for those promises you made to us, you too will be faithful, even when we perhaps have snubbed you, that you remain faithful, and we're thankful for that then. Amen.